Please be seated. Good afternoon, everyone. We are here on State versus LaFleur, S1SC 40965. Mr. Harrison, it looks like you've reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. You can enter your appearance and begin your argument.
May it please the court, I'm Carter Harrison for the defendant appellant Sean LaFleur. Your Honors, I'm going to focus on two of my arguments today. We have a broader in effect or in impact argument that in criminal cases, depositions can almost never be used outside from, of course, the child victim context where there are a specific set of rules. And then secondarily, the confrontation clause argument that here, in the way the court should interpret the exceptional circumstances and necessity requirements, they were not met by the efforts that were undertaken by the state. Now, the first argument, while it may seem like a bigger ask, to be clear, I have a line of authority that is directly on point. And what the state is actually doing is, albeit sub silentio, because they have not addressed three-fourths of that line, is arguing for the overruling of particularly McGinnis, but really the entire Berry, Mann, McGinnis, and Cordova line of cases, which, starting with Berry, make clear that what later became, before its destruction, 5-503N, which is the criminal equivalent of Rule 32 in the civil rules, which is the rule governing use of a deposition at trial versus its taking. Berry made clear that it is what abrogated the common law, that there were no criminal depositions, and it is the only authority. Now, okay, alone, you may say, well, what about 804? Maybe the Berry court wasn't thinking about it. In fact, in Berry, while the prior testimony exception existed as a common law artifact, the rules of evidence didn't exist yet. That is no longer true for the remaining three cases in that line of case law, where not only did the rules of evidence exist, including Rule 804 B1, in its current form, but McGinnis specifically addressed. The holding in McGinnis is, no, 804 B1 does not authorize the use of a deposition in a criminal trial. Only 5503N does. So it isn't just the second part, the only 5503 works. They go the extra mile. This court went the extra mile to, in fact, rebut the very argument that the state is making.
What rule was McGinnis applying?
I'm so sorry.
What rule was McGinnis applying?
McGinnis considered both 5503 and 804, 11804.
It was a predecessor, wasn't it? 29?
Mm-hmm. Rule 29 of the criminal rules was how it was denominated at the time.
And that's changed.
It's been eliminated. It was first changed to recodified at 5503, and then eliminated in 2000, Your Honor, by the first committee and then this court. So the state's argument, which again is a sub silentio argument, since they just don't address McGinnis, let alone Mann and Cordova.
Isn't the change in the language to Rule 29N that exists now an important distinction that cabins McGinnis to its time? It's no longer consistent with our rules. McGinnis is now an aberration.
So McGinnis was Rule 29A. My understanding is at the time, just the codification system was different. We didn't use the current system of set of rules hyphen rule numbers.
I'm talking about the actual words. The words that McGinnis was interpreting don't exist in our rules anymore.
Correct, yes. But I guess
the idea that McGinnis somehow controls what we're doing in this case is...
Sorry, and I may have misunderstood.
Not a veil.
So Rule 29A became Rule 5503, Rule 29N became Rule 5503N, I believe without any difference, without any difference that anyone has suggested makes a difference. Those two rules are now gone and they're deleted. And yes, I think that for the state's argument to hold any water, the argument has to be that, well, now that we've deleted this rule that McGinnis said was the sole basis, the only basis for criminal depositions to be used in a criminal trial, That now has to change the interpretation of Rule 11-804-B1.
How does your argument square with Lopez and Stalter?
I apologize, Your Honor, if you could remind me of what the
Lopez is, uses the reasonableness standard from Rule 11-804. Stalter also focuses on evidence that a reasonable effort was made to secure the unavailability.
So on the question of the efforts undertaken, there's both the 804, the rules of evidence standard, which I'll concede are lower, because the rule obviously applies equally in criminal and civil cases. They're what would be reasonable for a standard litigant who resembles a criminal defendant more than the state to undertake. The Confrontation Clause imposes a separate requirement of exceptional circumstances and necessity that applies only to the state. And that, of course, makes perfect sense, because the reality is when it comes to finding a witness, the state has plenary power as a practical matter to find who they want to find and not find who they don't want to find. And that's, you know, it makes perfect sense, again, in cases like this, where they have good testimony in the can, in the form of the deposition. These are folks who are, for a variety of reasons, worrisome witnesses. Not just they're not going to appear, but they're going to appear and do something strange. They're going to change their story, et cetera. Frankly, I can't blame the state for not wanting to find these people. What they wanted to do was satisfy the standard and be able to use the deposition, not to actually find these folks. And I would present as the hypothetical, just the counterexample of, had these individuals sat and given a deposition that was exculpatory to Mr. LaFleur, then met ex parte in the state's offices and gave the testimony that condemned Mr. LaFleur, which obviously would be indisputably unusable at trial, would those witnesses have been found for this trial? And the answer is, of course they would have, because the state would have wanted them found and wanted them produced to give live testimony at trial.
What about 5613B? This is the rules of evidence, so far as they're applicable and not in conflict with these rules, shall apply to and govern the trial of criminal cases.
Sure. So that rule was around for again, the same three of the four. That's an original rule. So if it made a difference, then it would have affected the outcome in Mann, McGinnis, and Cordova. Now, I can't say that Mann, McGinnis, and Cordova actually addressed that rule. It's obviously a broad conceptual rule. But it's not
how
like
how do you address the plain language of that rule?
And I apologize, Your Honor. I know I've addressed the argument briefly in the reply brief, but I don't recall what the
rules of evidence, so far as they are applicable and not in conflict with these rules, shall apply to and govern the trial of criminal cases.
Sure. I guess I just view that as an interlocking, as the way of saying that, you know, when you're in a civil trial, you're effectively governed by the rules of civil procedure and the rules of evidence. When you're in a criminal trial, you're effectively governed by the rules of criminal procedure and the rules of evidence.
There's parts of the rules where they apply to both civil and criminal, where the rulemaking committee has made clear that in civil cases, it's a different standard than criminal. That was not done with 11-804, so why would we believe that it doesn't apply equally and in full force with criminal cases?
No, I think that that Rule 11-804 itself does apply equally in civil and criminal cases, because it's a rule of evidence. And it does, as I've just conceded, present a lower standard for the proponent to clear. Mm-hmm. However, as is often the case with the Confrontation Clause, which does apply on top of the rules of evidence and is a barrier just to the state in criminal cases, these requirements of exceptional circumstances and necessity, they stem from the Confrontation Clause.
So where in State v. Lopez, 2011, New Mexico Supreme Court 35, did this court apply exceptional circumstances in the Confrontation Clause analysis portion of the opinion?
I apologize, Your Honor. I do have the part 3A is the federal case law, and part 3B of the reply catalogs the New Mexico case law applying those standards. I don't believe there's any dispute that the standards exist.
Okay.
I think that the question is whether they were satisfied here by the state's by the state's efforts.
So is your argument that maybe they, state was able to show unavailability under 804, but they're not able to show unavailability under the confrontation clause?
We've argued the gamut, but that is certainly a conceptual possibility, yes.
But doesn't that run afoul of our own case law? You have State versus Gonzalez, 1992, New Mexico Supreme Court at 3, where we presume unavailability under the confrontation clause if 804 is met. And the federal cases do the same exact thing, Barber versus Page as an example.
Sure. So to be honest, I'm never quite sure what to do with pre-Crawford confrontation clause case law from either the federal courts or this court. It really was a sea change, and you just see a lot of stuff in the pre-Crawford cases that just isn't accurate anymore. Again, I don't believe that it's... Again, we've cited a number of cases. I think, you know, Wright and Miller collects cases and says it the most clearly. I understand Wright and Miller obviously is not, is not this court, but we cited the top of page 13 of my reply brief. Compliance with Rule 804A is no guarantee that the standard required by the Confrontation Clause has been met. And so I guess I would defer to Messrs. Wright and Miller on the correctness of that statement, which I do think answers Your Honor's question.
How do we deal with your client's consent to not being present for the depositions and the myriad warnings and latitude given to your client by the trial court saying, you know, if you change your mind, let me know. You know, do you understand the consequences of what you're doing and the waiver argument?
I thought it was irrelevant and so irrelevant that the state was politely critical of me for not reciting it in the factual section. I think it is irrelevant. He very clearly...
You can waive your confrontation rights.
He very clearly waived his right to be present at the deposition.
And was warned of the consequences.
And was warned that it is possible. I think he wasn't told this is going to be used at the trial.
Because nobody knows at that point. But he was given, to my mind, a very fair warning. And it also that the judge here went further than the average judge by saying, you know, you really need to think about this. And if you change your mind, let me know and I will have you transported. Because I think the judge was concerned about how broadly his waiver was going to be used in this case, given what they knew about these witnesses already.
The state has taken the position that in New Mexico, there is no right for the defendant to be present at a criminal deposition. I disagree. However, that right was not violated here because he waived it. That is the extent of the waiver, I believe, the full colloquy, which we repeated in section one of the reply brief, makes that very clear what the scope of this waiver was, hey, you're not going to be there at the deposition. This deposition, the judge made clear, I'm not saying the deposition is going to be used at trial. If it is, then obviously that will result in you never being present at, you never you having might, a face-to-face confrontation.
This testimony might be used in your trial. This is just from the summary. And you would not have the opportunity to have face-to-face confrontation with these witnesses. It doesn't just say at the deposition. He's saying at trial. The judge is saying at trial.
Which
you're going to waive it.
But that's just a necessary consequence of if the deposition is determined to be usable. And again, let's say that this waiver had never happened. I would be up here in addition arguing that the defendant, that Mr. LaFleur had a right to be present at the deposition, because I think he does. And the state has denied that. But that's the right we're talking about, is the right to be present at the deposition. Most states recognize that. The federal Rule 15 recognizes that if there's a deposition taken, the defendant needs to be there. Arguably New Mexico and Florida are the only states, the only jurisdictions I could find where, and Florida actually says that the defendant can't be there at the deposition. And that is consistent with my conceptualization of the deposition as a discovery device versus what most other jurisdictions, including the federal courts, characterize the criminal deposition as, which is a Davin-esque trial preservation device. You know, it's a way to get to put testimony in the can for use at a trial. Florida's made very, very clear with a large body of case law that that's not the case. We obviously adopted Florida's deposition rule here in New Mexico, And it has features like arguably not allowing the defendant to be present at the deposition. Again, whether that right actually exists is irrelevant because he did waive it. But to me, again, looking at the colloquy, which we, you know, this was addressed in pretty painstaking detail in the reply. And I just think it's very clear what the scope of that waiver was, which is, okay, I'm not going to be present at the depo. And I understand that obviously what that means is if all that happens at trial is they play this depo, I'm never going to have a face-to-face confrontation. Frankly, this is really not a case about, I mean, face-to-face confrontation is part of what goes into that first argument, the McGinnis argument about like why the rules are written the way they are, and my policy arguments opposing the state's request that that this court overrule its line of four cases, most notably McGinnis, and the holding in that case.
We're moving pretty fast here for me, but as I understand your argument that you made starting, is your argument is that McGinnis still rules, still governs?
Correct, Your Honor.
Was McGinnis grounded in the state constitution or the federal constitution?
McGinnis was not a constitutional case for my purposes. It addresses some constitutional
issues. It's a rule.
It is about the interaction between the common law, which says no depositions, rule what is now 5503, what is at time 29N, which then permitted and is, as McGinnis made clear, is the only basis for depositions in a criminal, for using depositions in a criminal case. And what makes McGinnis special among that line is it went the further step of saying, no, not 11804B1. 11804B1 is not an independent basis. Only what is now Rule 5503N is an adequate basis for admitting a deposition in a criminal case.
So your next step is 11503 was not satisfied?
I apologize, Your Honor. There's 5503, which has been removed.
So you're relying on McGinnis, which interpreted a rule that no longer exists.
Yes. Okay. The interpretation remains sound.
I just
want to
make sure I'm understanding.
And to be clear, what this will now require is, because McGinnis didn't just interpret 5503N, it interpreted 11804B1.
But it was not grounded in constitutional law.
That's true.
Confrontation under state or federal law. It was interpreting the then existing rules, which now no longer exist.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. My broader argument, which is that aside from child victim cases, depositions are not admissible. They can be taken but not used in criminal cases, is a rules-based argument.
And you're relying on McGinnis for that proposition.
I'm relying on the entire case, the entire Barry Mann McGinnis Cordova. Okay. Line of cases, Your Honor, and by the way, and case law that predates that says there is no basis, you know, prior to.
So there's currently no rule which prohibits use of depositions. You agree with that?
This court specifically erased the one rule that it held did.
Okay, and you're also not arguing that confrontation, state, federal or state constitutional right to confrontation, does not ban the use of depositions.
Our constitutional argument is narrower in effect, and it would focus on the fact that this type of unavailability, and there's a strong version of my argument that says that this court should be very skeptical of non-death, of we can't find them brands of unavailability versus things like death because of the possibility of the overwhelming possibility of state's gamesmanship, and then a weaker but more fact-specific argument of look at what they did here. This is clearly not enough.
What is the standard of review? Did the child court address whether or not the witness was unavailable?
He did, Your Honor. And so for the 804 standard, which is the bottom standard and the one that I want to focus the least on because it's the lowest, it is just a purely lower standard than the unavailability and necessity standard, he would get abuse of discretion review. But for my statutory interpretation argument, the McGinnis argument, that's obviously de novo. And then I contend that the confrontation clause, the question of whether the efforts were adequate as a constitutional matter, is also reviewed de novo. So again, Your Honors, what the state is requesting is, you know, requesting sub silentio, is an overruling, make no mistake, of this court's line of four consecutive cases saying the exact same thing, one of which is in derogation of the common law, which for a long time said there were no criminal depositions, we now have a basis, a sole basis, Rule 29N now, which was later relocated to 5503N, for depositions in a criminal case and using depositions in a criminal trial. McGinnis goes farther to say, to be clear, not 11804B1. That is not a basis. Only 29N come 5503N. We then have the erasure of Rule 5503N, and that puts us back to where we started, as is the case in general when there is a statutory change in derogation of something that this court has said. I am not familiar with any principle of any canon of statutory construction that would have us reinterpret 11804B1 to become stronger in light of the deletion of another rule and another set of rules, like a criminal rule of criminal procedure. The reality is, and by the way, this is entirely, while it's a little surprising, I guess, this is entirely consistent with the structure of why we have this specific rule for child victim cases and why we put all these additional procedural protections on it, right? If in fact, in an adult case, it's just way easier to use a deposition at trial, that really doesn't make any sense. It very clearly, you know, the passage of an authorization for the use of depositions in criminal trials in the child victim context was obviously this court going out of its way to make usable depositions in a context where they wanted to protect child victims and for various policy reasons that are fairly clear.
If there was a pretrial hearing in this case, which a witness testified under oath was subject to cross-examination, would that be admissible in trial?
I apologize, this is a hypothetical.
It is hypothetical. It didn't happen here, but let me form in a non-hypothetical. Can a pretrial hearing under oath subject to cross-examination be used at trial?
So, Your Honor, I addressed this very briefly. It was not argued by the state. Okay. Interestingly enough, though, it's in fact like a preliminary hearing is in fact easier to use at trial and has been held to be subject to basically you just have to clear the 11804B1 standard.
Okay.
And I'll try to find my pen site in my reply. But there's a number of reasons for that, including that a judge was there ruling on objections. That you're there, that is in fact the exact same motive, which is to prove or disprove the crime just to a much lower standard, probable cause versus beyond a reasonable doubt. So there are various reasons for that to be different. But Your Honor is correct that in fact, preliminary hearing or any hearing, I guess, where the witness is sworn in and cross-examined, yes, would then just be subject to the 804B1 standard. But again, there are just...
Would there be the opportunity of a client for your counsel to object to any statement? Let's say there was an error that the judge would be able to correct live. Could the judge correct that and say that part of the statement's not coming in as far as the preliminary hearing, or in this case, a deposition?
Yes, and I suppose it's if we're talking about the gatekeeping functions right at the doorstep of trial.
Sure, because it seems to me your argument is, look, it's not the same thing because I have a judge sitting in the room. I'm suggesting that judges can also correct inadmissible statements even if they're recorded in advance and under oath. Is that not possible?
It obviously is true that you could do the civil process, of course, of right. Submitting deposition transcripts and doing objections.
Okay.
So I don't know that necessarily is what I would point at. But I'll say first and foremost, like, make no mistake, my argument for why depositions are treated sure. separately than preliminary hearings is because there is a line of four cases saying exactly that. I acknowledge that hearings are treated more softly, and I've tried to give some reasons that might be the case. But whether the court is persuaded, but that those reasons really justify that disparate treatment is secondary to the question of the fact that the court has held this not one, not two, not three, but four times, including in McGinnis, squarely rebutting what is now the state's implicit tacit argument. Thank you, Your Honor. I see my time has expired.
Thank you. Ms. Street, if you'll enter your appearance, you may begin. You have 30 minutes.
just going to adjust this first. All right. Krista Street, on behalf of the state, may it please the court. The defendant shot his wife, Nancy, in the back of the head. After he murdered Nancy, the defendant wrapped her body in a tarp, buried her body, and placed rocks on top of her body. The jury convicted the defendant of first-degree murder and tampering with evidence. Turning to the reasons why this court should affirm the defendant's convictions, there are essentially three topics that control the analysis of this appeal. The Confrontation Clause, witness unavailability under Rule 11804A5A, and the former testimony exception to the rule against hearsay, Rule 11804B1, which allows the district courts to admit the deposition testimony of a witness who is unavailable to testify at trial. I'll address each topic in turn. The first question...
Can I ask you to slow down a little bit so I can...
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
I'm a slow learner.
I apologize. So the first question before this court is whether admitting the sworn deposition testimony of two unavailable witnesses violated the defendant's rights under the Confrontation Clause. The answer is no. Pursuant to Crawford v. Washington and State v. Soze, both this court and the United States Supreme Court recognize that the Confrontation Clause allows for the testimonial statements of a non-testifying witness to be introduced at trial when the witness is unavailable to testify at trial and the defendant had a prior opportunity for cross-examination. And that's precisely what... Oh,
can I ask you a question on that?
Yes.
And it doesn't seem to be argued, at least with much force, by anybody. What's bothering me in this case, more than anything else with regard to unavailability, the state lists these two witnesses, and for an address it says care of the district attorney's office. That to me is an explicit representation that we know where these witnesses are. Their address, and they're to be located care of the DA's office. And at no time was that representation ever changed or saying, you know, we're losing contact with them or they're not checking in or whatever the basis is for making that representation. I'd like to, if you don't mind, if you could, and like I said, it wasn't brief, but it's something that's really bothering me, and I see it a lot in these pretrial orders, witness so-and-so care of DA's office. Sometimes there's legitimate reason for protecting their address and not making it public. Mm-hmm. But this may be one of those cases, but that it carries with it a representation. You know where they are. And that apparently was not the case here.
Yes, Your Honor. To that, I would answer that the defendant has always been on notice. Ever since the district court's colloquy with the defendant in July 2024, the defendant and his trial attorney were placed on notice that these witnesses were difficult to locate. In this case...
Everybody knew that. Okay. But you're not answering my... The state said, we know where they are. Care of the DA. So all the defendant should have had to do, or the DA had to do, was knowing their address, go give them a subpoena. The fact that they're, what is it, home challenged or
I believe
home
they're
insecure.
They were housing insecure.
You know, and the transient, everybody knew that, mm-hmm. including the DA. Mm-hmm. But the DA never changed its representation, care of. And I know I'm taking a lot of time. I apologize.
Oh, no, that's quite all right. It was about 5 weeks prior to trial where the state filed its notice of intent to allow the deposition testimony of these two unavailable witnesses. So, yes, Your Honor, I do agree that the witnesses were listed under the care of the attorney's district attorney's office. But in this case, 5 weeks leading up to trial, the defendant was on notice that the state was trying to locate these men and that the state did not know where they were.
Okay.
I'd like to take a moment to address defendant's case law that he relies on, the Barry, McGinnis, Mann, and Cordova cases. The reason why I only address the Barry case in my answer brief is that all four of those cases stand for the same proposition. All four of those cases stand for the proposition that Rule 29N is the sole authority for admitting depositions at trial. And in the 1970s, under Rule 29N, that was the case. But Rule 29N which became Rule 5-503N, was taken off the books in 1999. So to the extent that those cases hold that Rule 29N is the sole authority for admitting depositions, the state believes that that is no longer good law because depositions are clearly admissible under Rule 11804B1A. Lawful depositions are listed as an example of former testimony. Right.
And that's under the Confrontation Clause. Independent of any rule?
No, Your Honor, I apologize. That's Rule 11804B1A. That lists.
I understand that, but they're admissible under the Confrontation Clause, which is not a rule.
Oh, yes, Your Honor, the statements are admissible under the Confrontation Clause. The standard for unavailability under the Confrontation Clause, as recognized by the United States Supreme Court in Hardy v. Cross, which is 565 U.S. at 65, the standard for unavailability is when the state has made a good faith effort to obtain a witness's presence at trial, that satisfies the defendant's Sixth Amendment's standard for unavailability. And here we have a finding from the district court that the efforts made by the state were in good faith. So we satisfy the standard for unavailability under the Confrontation Clause. And I'd like to take a moment to discuss.
Before you move on.
Yes.
Defense seems to suggest that the standard under the Confrontation Clause is more stringent than under the rules. What's your response to that particular perspective?
I would respectfully disagree with that standard. I think that Rule 11804B1 actually provides a slightly higher standard than the Confrontation Clause. But I would just like to briefly address the defendant's claim that the state needs to prove necessity and exceptional circumstances. I would respectfully disagree with that. The word necessity, when I often see that word in Confrontation Clause jurisprudence, that's in cases like Maryland v. Craig or State v. Thomas. So in Maryland v. Craig, there were four children who were available to testify at trial. They were just testifying in a different room. And the Supreme Court in that case found that the district court had made a finding of necessity to allow for a substitute procedure. In State v. Thomas, in this court's case, the witness testified via Skype. She was available to testify at trial. So we should not be using the phrase necessity in cases where we're talking about witnesses who are unavailable, when the word necessity often comes up in cases where there's substitute procedures for available witnesses. And regarding the language of exceptional circumstances, that is a quote from, again, McGinnis, and that is interpreting a rule that hasn't been on the books for decades. So the state would argue that exceptional circumstances to admit deposition testimony is not the standard. The correct standard for admitting deposition testimony is the standard articulated in Rule 11804B1. And even if this court does hold that exceptional circumstances are required, we met that here. The state engaged in significant efforts to find these men. And I'd be happy to discuss the state's efforts to locate these witnesses if the court would like me to.
This is good to you.
Well, the district judge wrote a very thorough order on that, and we can read that. And I there's no challenge to whether substantial evidence supports those factual findings. So for my purposes, I'm happy.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
My question on that similarly is the standard of review. And it suggests that it's de novo on the unavailability with regard to the Confrontation Clause. Do you agree with that?
I believe that this is perhaps an opportunity for clarification, because there's not a lot of case law in New Mexico about what the standard of review for unavailability is. In the 1996 Lopez case, it's a two-part standard of review for determining unavailability. It's substantial evidence principles for the factual findings, and then a de novo standard of review for the district court's legal conclusions. And then when we turn to the actual admission of the deposition, that's a lot more clear. That's clearly an abuse of discretion standard.
Is it the state's position that the standard for unavailability is the same under a Confrontation Clause in 804?
I believe there's slightly different. New Mexico case law has interpreted the requisite efforts that law enforcement needs to make as due diligence and good faith. The Supreme Court has held that good faith efforts are sufficient, so I believe New Mexico might provide a slightly more elevated standard than the federal standard, but there's...
So let me push back a little bit on the idea. It's my understanding, it's black letter law, that satisfying a hearsay exception rule does not by itself ipso facto satisfy confrontation. But, and that's been said over and over again by the U.S. Supreme Court, but I've never yet seen a case which differentiates where that is differentiated. It's not necessarily satisfying one, does not necessarily satisfy the other in all cases. But then there's no case which actually describes the difference or where they've applied a difference.
I apologize. I'm not sure I understand Your Honor's question. I do agree with Your Honor that the standard under the confrontation, that whether evidence is admissible under the confrontation clause is a different analysis than the admissibility of evidence under Rule 11804B1. But could you, did I answer your question? Okay. I would like to address the defendant's allegation that the state's position is that a defendant never has the right to appear at a deposition. That is not the position the state's answer brief took. My intent in pointing out that the rule is silent on whether or not defendants should attend was to point out that the state made every effort in this case to get the defendant to attend the deposition. The state prepared a transfer order, sent it to the district court judge. So even though the rule doesn't require it, the state attempted to get the defendant there, and that was my intent in discussing the deposition rule. Are there any further questions from the court regarding the confrontation clause? I'll turn briefly to the rules of evidence and the rules of criminal procedure. And again, we're under an abuse of discretion standard here, which is very deferential to the findings of the district court. And I want to make it clear, the state is not asking the court to reinterpret Rule 11804B1. The rule explicitly states lawful depositions are an example of former testimony that are admissible at trial. And that's what the district court applied here. The state does not want that standard to change. The rule and the standard articulated in the rule is clear, and the district court did not abuse its discretion in applying the plain meaning of the rule in this case. And I'd also like to point this court's attention to the committee commentary to Rule 5-503. So the committee commentary to Rule 5-503, which is the rule in this case that the parties relied on for the taking of the deposition, states, quote, "The rules of evidence relating to the admissibility of evidence are applicable to evidence admitted by depositions." So the committee commentary of the rule that allows for the taking of the depositions contemplates that depositions are admissible at trial. I would be happy to discuss the three requirements of Rule 11804B1 if this court is interested in that, or if this court has any questions.
I'd like for you to address the issue of this cross-examination, the opportunity for cross-examination, and the argument that the motive was different pre-trial than it would have been post-discovery of material that was not available at the time of the deposition.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you don't mind.
No, not at all. So the district court found that the defendant had this not... So, I'm sorry, let me back up. So Rule 11804B1, subsection B, requires that the party had a similar motive to develop the testimony by cross-examination. Here, the district court's finding went above and beyond that. The district court found that the defendant had the same motive. Furthermore, The district court observed that even though Donald had testified that the defendant called him on a Sunday, which would have been February 25th, and the fact that the phone records showed that the defendant, that the defendant called Donald on the 26th. I'm sorry, I'm going to take a step back. What Donald testified to was that the defendant called him on a Sunday. When they get access to the phone records, when both parties get access to the phone records, they realize the phone calls happened on a Monday. And the district court correctly observed that regardless of whether the confession took place on a Sunday night in February or a Monday night in February, the defendant's motive during the cross-examination was still the same, that the defendant would want to, the defendant's motive would still be to show that Mr. Pledger was not a credible witness and that the alleged confession never occurred. Furthermore, this court's State v. Lopez case discusses cases such as State v. Gonzalez and State v. Henderson that recognize that even when a defendant's theory of defense changed from self-defense to identification after the relevant witness had testified, the defendant still had a similar motive to develop the testimony at the preliminary hearing. And in this case, the defendant never changed his defense theory. It has always been an alleged identification defense. Sorry, an alleged identity defense, mistaken identity defense, I beg your pardon. So in this case, given that the defendant's theory of defense never changed and the phone records only showed that the phone call took place on a Sunday night and a Monday night, the district court properly found the defendant's motive to cross-examine at the deposition was the same as it would have been at trial, and this court should uphold the district court's conclusion on that matter. I'd also like to point out, as I've just mentioned State v. Lopez, this court recognizes that preliminary hearing testimony of an unavailable witness is permissible under Rule 11804b1, given that Rule 11804b1 also extends to lawful depositions. It's just a natural conclusion that lawful depositions are admissible at trial when the witnesses are unavailable.
But Mr. Harrison makes the point, and it's not it noted this point, is that a preliminary hearing is slightly different than a deposition because you have the judge available to act as, you know, as a gatekeeper. And that makes it easier for the use of a testimony at a preliminary hearing than the idea of a deposition. Can you address his distinction?
Yes, Your Honor. During the deposition of the two witnesses, the parties noted that if either the state or the defendant's attorney wanted to object to a question, that they could object and that they would wait for the judge to make a ruling on that objection. So even though there wasn't a judge there, the way the parties conducted the deposition, they conducted the deposition as if there were a judge there and said that if anybody wants to object to testimony, we'll note that for the record and the judge can rule on it later. And I'd like to point out one more observation that the district court made regarding preliminary hearing testimony and how it's admissible. He said that videotaped depositions are actually better than preliminary hearing testimony because in this case, the deposition was videotaped, as I've mentioned, probably too many times. So the jury was able to observe the witness's demeanor, whereas in preliminary hearing testimony, which is admissible under Rule 11804b1, the jury doesn't get to see the demeanor because it's usually just a tape recording. Are there any further questions from the court? I'll just take a brief moment to conclude. The state respectfully requests this court uphold the defendant's convictions for first-degree murder and tampering with evidence. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Harrison, 6 minutes.
Your Honor, to briefly go through a couple quick points. Justice Feehill, I do believe that we preserve the issue of the care of district attorney's office on the brief in chief at page 3. We cited the, 6 instances where that's how they listed these witnesses. We do view that as an assertion by the state that the witness is under their control.
But they respond that 5 weeks prior to trial, they said, we can't find him. So they did change their notice. So as of 5 weeks, that's her response, is that we filed a notice to take the deposition, that we wanted to take a deposition because they were unavailable or going to become unavailable.
I agree.
And they found them, and the depositions were taken at that time.
My understanding is that, if I recall correctly, and I apologize if this is incorrect, but I believe some of the witness lists posted
the depo. The witness list did say that. Then 5 weeks before trial, they said, we want to take the deposition because these guys are all over the place and we may not be able to find them. And then you stipulated taking the depositions. And I didn't go through the depositions, but I assume there was no questions asked about where they're going to be living in the next 5 weeks.
The depositions were taken very early, so kind of strangely early in the case. I think it was less than, if you map it out on a timeline, less than one-fourth of the way from indictment to trial. And I believe that some of the witness list produced after the deposition did. And that's part of the problem of why new evidence was produced. It's probably perfectly timely discovery, but it really changed how that cross-examination would have gone.
But the only new evidence you're relying on is the incorrect data of the phone records. Is that right?
I apologize, Your Honor.
Probably not. The only evidence you're relying on to show a change of theory or prejudice, I know prejudice isn't an element, I'm just using that word, but is the incorrect date of the phone conversation between the witness and the defendant?
The phone records more broadly, which had a couple of takeaways that would have been, you know, topics for cross-examination, certainly. Now, I admit that the case law in this vein is not super favorable thing, you know.
Okay.
Innovations that are significant have sometimes been held to that happens. I do want to point out, again, this was an early deposition, so a lot of really important things happened. But that is an area where I've got an uphill slog in terms of the case law that exists, Your Honor. What I will say is that I did want to respond to the state's, what I view as kind of the core argument of the state about how they respond to McGinnis, which is that the state's argument proceeds from the assumption, it works backward from the conclusion that criminal depots must be admissible at a criminal trial. So if the court previously said emphatically that Rule 29N and 503N was the only basis for criminal depots, and then that rule gets deleted, then now the basis for criminal depots must be something else, including, and in fact, the thing they've pointed to is a rule that, in fact, this court has specifically held is not a basis for criminal depots, that being 11804B1. We don't agree with that. We think the lawful depot language in 804 bolsters our point. That is a reference to lawful under things like the rules of criminal procedure. Justice Beal, I slightly misstated an answer to yours where you asked if something was admissible under the Confrontation Clause. Obviously, the Confrontation Clause doesn't make anything admissible. It excludes things. What I meant was it doesn't exclude these types of depositions. These types of depositions need to be authorized under the rules, and that's an analysis that's separate from the Confrontation Clause analysis. I would, I guess, disagree with your characterization that it seems like, in general, the two are the Confrontation Clause and the hearsay rules are interpreted in tandem. Bruton is a very common one where a co-conspirator statement makes a statement that would be admissible as a statement against interest, but that is inadmissible in a trial and requires severance because it would be a testimonial statement by someone.
But in this
context,
they are very similar, wouldn't you agree? I mean, in the context of using prior sworn testimony, I think 11804 has a couple of additional requirements that are not needed in the confrontation.
There is an unavailability standard under 804B1, 804 in general, I guess, and an unavailability standard under confrontation to where I would say one is just higher than the other, but more limited in its applicability. It applies to the state in a criminal case versus to all parties. So there's a reason for it to be higher. And again, given we know the resources of the state, unique among litigants in both the civil and criminal context, that makes perfect sense. Your Honor, I guess I will close by saying that it's a double-edged sword that we now have video depositions. When I started my career, it was taught to trial lawyers as a matter of trial advocacy that you don't want to put on depots, you'll bore the jury to death. Because back in the day, it was you put somebody on the stand to read and they weren't allowed to do dramatic reading, and it was terrible. That's not the case today. Juries are as I've tried doing it in civil cases, juries are perfectly fine watching these video depos. And so if the court opens the door to freewheeling admission of video depositions in criminal cases, I have every reason to believe that the state will make the rational decision that the state made in this case, which is, we've got these witnesses, they seem super unstable, who knows what they're going to do. We got them down sober with hair combed and got a good performance from them in the can. Maybe we'll find them, maybe we won't. We're perfectly fine playing their depo to the jury. And Your Honor, I think that is completely incompatible with the Confrontation Clause, not just the Confrontation Clause proper, but the way that this court has incorporated those concepts in its rules of criminal procedure. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel, for your presentations, for your briefing. They were very helpful. The court will take this matter under advisement. The case is deemed submitted as of today, and we will get you a decision as soon as we're able. Thank you. Court's in recess.